You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. On tonight's show, I'm talking to the directors of the new documentary Black Gold, which is released in cinemas tomorrow, and is a film that seeks to challenge the Western world's perception of coffee and the lives of the farmers who gather the beans at their source. First up, here's an extract from the trailer.
From this area goes to the Western world for consumption. There is no coffee which is as quality as this coffee, but we are getting very low price.
Last year, the notional value of all of the coffee contracts that was traded is about $140 billion.
The workers here are getting less than half a dollar.
Which one is it?
Ethiopian.
Ethiopian one.
We must take the power back from these few people who go into green rooms and manipulate the rest of us.
Trade is more important to us than aid.
I'm talking to Mark and Nick Francis, the directors and producers of Black Gold. Do you want to introduce yourselves as well, so that you tell which voice is which? How did the project come about to start off with?
Okay, so Nick.
Hello.
So Black Gold came about partly because in 1997, about 10 years ago, I spent some time in Ethiopia and realised that this is a major coffee producing country, but it's not reaping any of the benefits, and how can that be? And then 6 years later, having made a few shorter films, we heard that Ethiopia was going to face another massive food crisis, similar to what happened in 1984, which prompted the first Live Aid concerts. This time, coffee farmers, the most productive part of Ethiopia's workforce, were caught up in this new, you know, humanitarian disaster. And yet, we were seeing on the streets of London and all over the place that more and more coffee shops were opening up, and in fact the coffee industry was booming. It was reaching its peak, turning over about $80 billion, but the people behind the product were in crisis. So we wanted to make a film which rooted what was going on in Africa at that time in our everyday consumer lifestyle, and there's few other things than coffee which do that, and that's why Black Gold was centered around coffee, and that's why we went out to Ethiopia in mid-2003 to start shooting.
What's your background in film before you started the project? Mark?
A very limited background in film, actually. I studied Chinese at university and I'm living in China for a couple of years. But parallel to that, I had always had photography as a hobby.
Okay.
And also did a specialist course in Chinese cinema. And that kind of combination, together with what I was experiencing by seeing a completely different side to the world, as in what I was seeing in China, was the ultimate kind of strands of inspiration to get into documentary filmmaking.
I have to admit that after seeing your film, I did the same thing as your star, for want of a better word, did, and I went to the Tesco to see if I could find any Ethiopian coffee, and it was all Latin American. How did that situation come about in this country?
That's just partly where the movement, you know, started from.
Right.
And it's a lot to do with which organisations, which cooperatives can get fair trade certified and so on. But it points to a much bigger issue, which is, why is it that the countries that grow coffee aren't represented by companies from those countries on the shelves of places like Tesco's? Why aren't there Ethio Bucks or, you know, coffee companies from those regions? Why is that not the case? And the truth really behind that is the fact that international trade rules are designed in such a way as to make that almost impossible. And that's what Tedese, the main character in the film, points to when he's in that supermarket when he comes to the UK and looks for his coffee. Eventually he found the Ethiopian coffee, but it will be a long time before you see an Ethiopian-owned coffee company on the shelves, and that's when trade will become much fairer. when they start to reap some more of the benefits of a packet of coffee, which we pay £2.50, £3 for.
At the risk of playing devil's advocate, when you quote the price of buying a kilo of coffee in this country as being 10 times the amount that the farmers get paid for it, presumably there's also a wholesale price that coffee shops buy it at, and then they have to factor in the cost of machinery, staff, roasting, shipping, etc., etc.
You're 100% right. And that's not going to change, because for coffee to get from rural Ethiopia to, you know, a supermarket in this country, there's loads of chains. And indeed, what Tedese was trying to do and is trying to do, and that's why very much the film centered around his journey, is he's trying to connect the farmers as much as possible with the retailers and minimizing the amount of people in between, in order that he can return more money back to the coffee growers to limit the amount of processes that are in between the farmer and the consumer. That's what he's trying to do. And maybe one day there'll be an Ethiopian coffee company that can do all those processes. So no one's trying to say that you shouldn't have or can't have those processes, but it's who's doing those processes. And unfortunately, the way how things work at the moment is the coffee farmers simply supply the raw beans, and it's the bigger companies that earn most of the money. So when you buy a £2 cup of coffee, a farmer's getting less than 2 pence.
Since you found a coffee co-op that tries to organise a good deal for the farmers as best as possible, if you were to also look at the kind of farmers that, say, Starbucks or one of the corporations used to buy coffee from, they get even less money. Was that a route that you felt it wasn't worth going down because the fair trade was so little anyway, that to find an even worse situation would be, I don't know, too grueling for the audience?
Well, as soon as you get into that, it becomes very complicated, because there are farmers who supply to Tedese, but through his scheme, but also supply through other schemes. So only a proportion of what they do goes through that fair trade system. Also, there are coffee companies out there who say that they don't end up working with cooperatives. They work directly with the farmer, and through doing that, they get a better relationship they do by even going through cooperatives. It varies from situation to situation. I think ultimately, though, however it's done, the more direct relationships companies can invest with the coffee farming communities is undoubtedly going to have a much more positive impact on those communities.
You contrast the plight of the farmers and the attempts to get Ethiopian fair trade recognised with the ridiculous nature of the glamorisation of working for Starbucks and sort of all the accoutrements of making coffee as some sort of great art form. Did you find that a company like Starbucks tried to counter the arguments in your film the way that, say, McDonald's did when Super Size Me came out?
That's exactly what's happened. I mean, it's worth pointing out we did ask all the major companies to be in the film: Kraft, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Sara Lee, and Starbucks, and all of them declined. You know, it's worth also mentioning that this is the first time a feature documentary has been made about coffee. Mm. And a lot of people, surprisingly, haven't really thought about the story behind their coffee cup. You know, coffee's exploded in the UK, obviously around the world, but, you know, in London alone, 3.5 million cups of coffee are drunk every week. A new store is opening somewhere every single week. And I just don't think up to this point people have really questioned it. And so when coffee companies see what's going on and the amount of people who are watching the film and hearing about it, they get quite alarmed, because it's telling a different story to what they tell their consumers. If you go to any coffee shop in London, for example, you won't see any statistics, any story about what's really going on in the lives of the 25 million people involved in producing coffee. So that's why Starbucks mounted a charm offensive to very much flag up what they're trying to do in dealing with, you know, and working with coffee farmers. And that's why when we previewed the film at the London Film Festival, they called the film inaccurate and incomplete. And why when the film opened in Los Angeles, in the cinema there, they were urging people on their website to feel good about drinking Starbucks, despite the fact that black gold shows a reality where you see farmers losing out. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We've had thousands of people, you know, from all over the world start debating these issues on the forum. The key thing comes back to what I was saying before. It's a story that these companies don't want consumers to know, because if they do start really thinking about it, the worry is they won't go to that particular coffee company. In fact, when we had our world premiere at Sundance, one of the first responses we heard was from someone who divested $10,000 worth of stock out from one major coffee company and looked to reinvest it in another company. If that gets multiplied, you know, by many people, you can see why they're getting concerned. So the response With McDonald's and Starbucks, there is a parallel there, though the films are very, very different.
From the kind of interviews you must have done around visiting the New York Stock Exchange, the World Trade Organization, one thing your film doesn't really explore is, I mean, it shows that the West is happy to send charity and aid to the Third World, but it just seems inconceivable that if it's cheaper to help them sell coffee, then why don't they actually do that?
That's the ultimate question that we hope people will ask, and that's the most obvious one. I don't think you need a degree in from Oxford or Harvard to ask that most obvious question. Why is it that the kind of aid that we give is in the form of food aid that is only it's solving a temporary solution? If we are going to give aid, why isn't it invested in allowing, let's say, countries like Ethiopia have the tools to be independent themselves, you know, to be able to have their own factories, to be able to start to compete effectively? Why is it that the trade rules are such that if a country like Ethiopia tried to import a fully packaged, roasted and processed packet of Ethiopian coffee into this country, the tariffs we'd put up would be so high that we as consumers would never be able to buy it? Why are we doing that? On the one hand, on the other hand, giving them aid. And at the end of the day, it's a very, very serious and sinister scenario that needs to be called to account.
But aid is often referred to in the terms of whether it's tied or untied. Most of the aid going to countries like Ethiopia is what they call tied aid. It means that it's tied to certain conditions. And if you look at what's going on, Ethiopia is a perfect example. Or if you look at any other country, tied aid means you're going to change your policies to suit us, and that's the condition we're going to give you aid. And the consequence of that, for the last 20 years, not just in Ethiopia, but across Africa, has been absolutely devastating. If you take a country like Mali, aid goes into that country when there's a so-called crisis, rather than it being bought locally. And what that does, it destroys the local market. So people can't actually, so where they could have bought food locally, it's being brought in from thousands of miles away on American ships using American grain and so on, which, you know, keeps a business going the other part of the world. And so we've got to look at it in a much more global framework. The fact that aid undoes development rather than helps development.
Do you think that's perhaps because of, say, the system in America, where you can offset the tax you pay against charity donations rather than, say, the risk of investing in a company?
Absolutely. That's one part of it. And the other part is to look at the way how subsidies operate. And at the moment, European and American farmers are subsidised to the tune of $300 billion a year. And a lot of that grain that's then produced, or wheat, is then dumped in countries like Ethiopia, depressing the local market, and then other farmers go out of business. It's a crazy situation. And the reason why I don't think people have paid that much attention to it up to now is because when you see news reports coming out from Africa and you see a truck carrying USA on the bag with wheat, and you see people grabbing the wheat off those bags, there's a scene in Black Gold exactly like this. You know, people are reluctant to criticize that because charity has this notion of goodness. And yet, in the food aid world, and that's what we're talking about, food aid, aid is used as a political tool to make the country malleable, as one person described it to us, to the interests of Western countries. And it's a very worrying game. And, you know, farmers in some of these areas, unfortunately, don't have the power to resist it, because when you're in a crisis, you need an emergency response, and food aid is there to sort it out.
In a way, also, aid comes across a kind of new imperialism, that through philanthropy, countries can sort of get good press by donating, but they aren't actually doing any real good.
It's brilliant branding, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you see the USA food bags, you know, it's all, what does the image project around the world? It gives, you know, the image of America being a very powerful, successful and kind and giving nation, and, you know, and that's free advertising for something in which I certainly don't believe is the current state of America.
Do you think the current political climate, where films like yours and, say, Super Size Me, The Corporation, the films of Michael Moore, the reason they're getting cinema releases and are increasingly popular is because people don't feel that getting involved with regular politics, you know, voting, etc., they feel disenfranchised from, and so by sort of supporting these films, it's the only way they can actually protest against systems of government?
I think it's more to do with the fact that people are becoming starved of being able to access these kind of subjects being told in this way in a mainstream space. I think it's becoming harder. I mean, it's always been historically in the States, They've never had the history of kind of documentary filmmaking and even a news agenda like we've had in the UK. So a film coming out in the cinema, a documentary coming out in the cinema in the States is really a big event. Here, it's only been the last few years that what we see on television today is not in the same kind of way we were seeing on television 15 years ago. It's much harder now to really see something that's that's not talking about whether you're swapping your husband or your wife, or whether you've, you know, Big Brother or talent shows. They are the winners of getting viewers for television. So I think there's a huge, huge audience out there who, whilst they might enjoy those shows, still want to be engaging in asking in films that provoke bigger questions. And the cinema has become that place where we as filmmakers are finding a space in order to communicate that. And not just the cinema space, but then going on to DVD and then paralleling that with the internet. And then it ends up on television after that. Mm. But it never becomes like the first point and the only point. It kind of starts from that point outwards.
But I think, you know, the cautionary note within there is that there are, whilst these kind of films are maybe finding cinema as a place which TV once occupied, there are still thousands and thousands of films trying to, you know, use cinema because of it provides this amazing space. So I don't think the competition's any less, because there's, you know, 20, 30 films being released every week. And so it does rely, though, going back to your original question, on the audience to say, we want to see these kind of films, to show to cinemas that there is an audience for these. And I think so far, that's showing. Obviously, the challenge for independent documentaries is to somehow compete against the budgets of, you know, the Spider-Mans of this world. And that will always be a challenge.
One of the threats to these Ethiopian farmers that you mention is the subsidies for European farmers. To provide a counter-argument, poor farmers in this country would say that without subsidies they'd be homeless and jobless. I mean, I suppose there's a happy medium.
Well, there's two points there. I mean, that same argument about subsidies is also used to justify the arms industry. And there are people who say, well, you know, if we didn't have an arms industry, loads of people would be employed. But there's been countless reports that prove exactly the opposite, that there is engineers who work in the arms industry would be absorbed in many other areas of work. The thing about subsidies in Europe and North America is not actually the poorest farmers who are being subsidized, it's the largest and the richest landowners who are being subsidized. And there are many people who are working in agriculture in the UK who are also getting a really hard deal. And the subsidy system that we have disproportionately favours those people who don't actually even need the subsidies. But I think the wider point is that the way how subsidies work in Europe doesn't directly affect coffee prices, because obviously coffee isn't grown over here. But what it does do, it limits the opportunity for farmers in Ethiopia to move into, say, cotton, which is subsidised in Europe and North America. And so in some ways, it kind of almost emphasises the kind of hostage situation that they're in, because it limits the opportunities that they have to move into other products.
One other thing as well to add is that, you know, there are conditions placed on developing countries not to subsidise their own farmers. So if you are going to play, even if we follow down the lines of the subsidies, you know, you help your own people, then the conditions are set for developing countries when they borrow huge amounts of money from places like the World Bank that they can't subsidise their own people.
As filmmakers, when you first approached the subject, how did you find the co-op that was willing to let you film their people to start off with? And also, I mean, how did you get funding for the project?
We started originally with just the need to get out to Ethiopia and film the food crisis that was taking place. That was our main priority. Put our own money up to go off and start capturing that. While we were there, we started researching and looking around, trying to understand more about the Ethiopian coffee industry and who might help us illuminate that further. And Tedese was somebody who we went to do an interview with. And at the end of the interview, he said, I'm actually going to travel to London and Japan and America this year to meet buyers directly to sell our coffee. And me and it looked at each other and realised, my God, maybe we should be rethinking about how we're trying to make this film and follow Tedese and let him become the central narrative. And that began like a 2.5 year relationship of meeting him in different places around the world too. You know, to help tell the story that we tell. When you make a documentary where it's observational and you're following someone over a period of time, it's very hard to fund these kind of films, because you're never really operating within a finite space of time, knowing when something begins and ends. You're dictated by his life and where he's trying to go. So it was a very expensive production, which was fueled by, you know, the support of various funds and foundations that we're able to raise money for, ourselves putting our own, you know, our company putting our own kind of time and money into it, and then teaming up with other talented players in the film industry. We had a fabulous editor, Hugh Williams, working with us. We had a wonderful executive producer, Christopher Hurd, who has his own production company, working with us. And with all of us, we put our own resources and time into it to really put the, you know, enough time out there in the shooting and in the editing to really make tell that story.
And support was also drawn from organisations like Screen South, which is one of the regional agencies of the Film Council, the Sundance Institute, that was amazing in supporting the development of the film at a really critical stage. And then latterly we have the Channel 4 British Documentary Film Foundation, and subsequent to finishing the film we had a new company called the Doc Factory helping in the promotion, helping us to continue to promote the film worldwide, because at any moment the film is being screened probably in countless, don't know how many countries at any one time. Now obviously the next challenge for us is to see how it plays out in the UK when it comes out on June the 8th. We'll see.
One of the questions you answered earlier, talking about the dissemination of the information on the film, is it because the corporations like Starbucks, McDonald's, you know, big film industries, are trying to tailor the internet to selling their products, and so you're kind of using the medium against them in some respects, because the internet is all about the dissemination of information. And so surely when people see a film like this, it's going to be the first place they're going to go, you know, in the 21st century.
Absolutely. And for us, one of the most crucial factors in letting people know about the film, wherever it's screened around the world, is through the website, blackgoldmovie.com. What we found there was, not long after we released it at Sundance, when, whether it was Starbucks starting to react or other companies making noises about the film, people went to the web. Now we've got an average of 50,000 people every month going to the film's website, signing up, saying I want to see the film, or participating in a really lively forum. On that forum, big coffee companies like Starbucks are also participating, you know, because there's such a lively discussion going on there. And we're able to put all the screenings of the film on there. People can then sign up, find out at short notice where it's going to be screened. But it also makes sure that even in those countries around the world that aren't screening the film, people are finding out about it. So if there is a story around the film, whether it's a company reacting, it's being read by people wherever they are in the world. And I think that's what's helped propel these kind of films to audiences that otherwise wouldn't find out about them.
Yeah. If I could ask about some of the other people involved in the production, it's got a very distinctive soundtrack, the movie, and also the cinematography is particularly well composed for a documentary. It doesn't have that kind of on-the-hoof, handheld sort of look to it.
Well, interesting you flag up those two elements, two very important elements that we wanted to bring into the film, is to try and make sure, you know, to try and put as much as we can into the visual aesthetic and also into the music. From the visual side of it, it was mainly shot by myself on the main camera. Nick was doing second camera, and actually ended up on small digital cameras doing a lot of digital video cameras, doing a lot of the filming. And then we invested a lot of time in post-production to bring out the colours in the film itself, so we can bring out the greens of Ethiopia. In terms of the sound and the music, that was something that we tried to get going right the way on in the early process of the edit suite, was to introduce composers into that film. We were very lucky to work with two very talented composers and musicians, Joe Henson and Kunja Chatterton, and they helped us develop a soundtrack that was going with the first rough cut of the film, because we're quite keen to avoid an African cliche sounding soundtrack.
Sure.
And try and push it much more in a way of, you know, questioning the image through the kind of music we use and fuse Western influences in that, because it's half set here. And that eventually, out of that, we then developed we then took it on to another level when we did the fine cut of the film, when we were invited to the Sundance Filmmakers Labs in Utah. We spent a few days there in the mountains, and they set us up with a sound suite, and we hooked up with another composer. And we developed some ideas over about very intensive 3 or 4 days. And out of that, we then worked together with him, Andreas Capsalis, on the final soundtrack of the film. And fortunately enough, there was another guy who had access to a lot of Ethiopian samples of recordings that he had recorded several years before while he was in Ethiopia, that he lent into the mix of this soundtrack. There's also a feature track from Matthew Herbert entitled Starbucks, which he makes through the sounds of kind of Frappuccino noises and things like that. So that was how we ended up creating the soundtrack of the film.
Because I think it was always important for us to keep this or make this a cinema experience. So people come in and it's not about being forgiving to the fact that it's a documentary, but actually feel it, watch it, experience it like you're watching any non-fiction or fiction or film. You know, it's about having a cinema experience, and that's why we worked so hard after we shot it to kind of compensate for the fact that it was shot on reasonably cheap equipment, and then really work hard afterwards to try and bring that whole experience together.
And also, presumably, the interviews with people like the barristers and the manager of Starbucks, as much as the fact they're damning themselves with their own hubris, they also act as humorous moments to counterpoint the more serious stuff, which make it a lot more digestible as a film than if you were just to have a sort of political track for an hour and 20 minutes.
Absolutely right. I mean, the key thing, though, was to try and show as much as we could the fact that there are light and dark sides to the coffee industry. And we were constantly moving in the making of the film between those two worlds. And in some way, we wanted to convey that juxtaposition in the audience's experience of the way how they were to experience the film. And there are very enthusiastic people in the coffee industry. And if there's a whole global subculture in coffee, which few of us who aren't exposed to that, and certainly we weren't before we started making the film, are aware of. And it was somehow trying to bring that to screen. And some people find it funny, and other people who are in that world just see it as absolutely normal.
You did some interviews in Trieste. While you were there, did you find out what the average Italian knowledge of fair trade is? Because although you cover the Illy company and someone who has like a beautiful coffee machine in their local coffee shop, it'd be nice to also know like the views of the man on the street in Italy, because presumably in this country you're used to hearing the American point of view and the British, but perhaps not the European.
I think there isn't hardly anything going on in Italy as regards to fair trade. I think as far as Italy's going on, it's, you know, where can we neck the best espresso? And that's really the main priority. The whole idea of fair trade, you know, is really yet to be, I think, taken in grip of Italy. And I don't think that's just about consumerism. I think generally as a nation, in terms of how it perceives itself in global, you know, affairs. I mean, it doesn't attempt to become a player in the same way that the UK does Germany or even the US or Canada.
Looking at the increasing market for fair trade products, I mean, it'd be nice to think that corporations would gradually become philanthropic overnight, but presumably the whole eco-friendly fair trade market is driven by market forces.
Absolutely.
And so as more people buy fair trade products, the companies themselves produce more, and so it's a kind of self-fulfilling cycle. Have you already seen any kind of knock-on effect from this film? For example, people trying to seek out more Ethiopian coffee for their shop?
Yes, consumers are finding themselves, since they see Black Gold, wanting to find out more. People want to know what they can do, whether that's spending more time looking at on consumer products to see what is the company doing that shows or demonstrates there is some ethical values to the way in which they collect their produce, definitely. That's happening all the time. And outside of the consumer aspects, you know, there's people who are paying much more attention to what's happening in big international gatherings like the G8, which is due to happen very, very soon, you know, and the decisions being made here and how they affect developing countries and whether they should be thinking about that if they're going to take part in electing their next representative and how their policies on development should be out on the forefront as well.
But I think overall it's prompted a massive awareness that wasn't there before, and it has prompted people, not just consumers, but people working in the coffee industry. I mean, we get emails from people, for example, someone wrote in from Canada not long ago. He goes, you know, I'm a barista at Starbucks and I saw the film the other day. I'm simply not going to be able to serve a latte in the same way again. That's emblematic of the kind of thing that you hear all the time all over the world. And that kind of spills out onto the forum where these things are being discussed. And that's just a tiny measure of what's actually really going on, whether teachers or whoever, you know, they're really using it as this kind of opportunity, because in a very clear way it just spells out. It doesn't shout at the audience, because we didn't want to make a film which shouted at the audience. We wanted to show rather than tell. And in some way that does slightly separate from the films that you were talking about earlier, whether that's your Super Size Me's and the and Fahrenheit 9/11, the American films, because it's about, our main aim was to draw in an audience who otherwise weren't necessarily engaged in these issues, but people who just literally have their coffee and, you know, they're inspired to see a film about something they literally consume every single day, rather than making the assumption that people have got a problem with that. You know, there isn't one. It's just about trying to engage people and a new audience. And I think that's the thing that cinema can do. It can bring people to that public environment and have a night out and check out the film. And that's why I wanted to make it, which looked at both the light and the dark and play between the two.
And following the release of this film and hopefully, you know, the increasing success of it, what project are you guys going to be working on next?
It's a little bit too early to go into the detail of that. We're in the early development stages on two big projects. But it will certainly take forward this idea of encouraging people to re-question some of the things that we simply take for granted, but which form and define what we do on an everyday basis. It will tap into a much wider issue and something that, again, that hasn't been covered in film before.
If you'd like to know more about some of the issues raised in tonight's show, please visit www.readyformyclosesup.blogspot.com, where you'll find a variety of links, including the film's website, and I'm Ready for My Close-Up. We'll be back at the same time next week.